Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Legislative Tornado Shelter, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along for what has suddenly become a very, very busy week in political news. A headline-filled Tuesday has inspired this Wednesday podcast. Here to discuss Cohen and Manafort, a three-judge state panel that blocked two ballot questions, at least for the time being, and also the social media noise and the general debate following the downing of Silent Sam. Your guest is Brent Woodcock, special counsel for the General Assembly. Welcome back to the podcast, Brent.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me on. I feel quite safe in this very insulated room.
You've never been in here before. I don't think many of our listeners, at least I hope they haven't been in here before. This room is maybe 6 by 8. It is it's a dust ball. How would you describe this room?
Well, it's
insular.
Basically made of concrete, and it's insulated with foam. And if there was a place that you were going to kill someone, this would probably be it.
No comment. I have no weapons on me. Let's put this on you. You want to start with Confederate monuments, the news of the president, or three-judge panel? And I'll say off the top, I'll preface it with you do work for Republican leadership here, and you're going to be pretty limited in what you can say about this constitutional amendment issue or development.
Yeah, I'm a dealer's choice.
Okay. All right. Let's start with federal politics. Federal snapshot of yesterday. Paul Manafort was convicted of 8 of 18 charges against him. In kind of a whiplash moment elsewhere in the district, totally unrelated, not totally unrelated, but totally independent of that news, was the guilty plea from the president's fixer, Michael Cohen. 5 counts there. You have long been a critical conservative voice of this president. What was just your initial takeaway from these two, and push back at any point, significant developments that played out yesterday afternoon?
I mean, I definitely think that they were significant. I mean, I guess my reaction was no surprise. I mean, you surround yourself with a group of supervillains and they're going to commit crimes. They're going to do things that they shouldn't do. They're going to embarrass the president, and they're going to embarrass the presidency itself. That campaign was overrun by people who had bad intentions, who were not the top flight of the Republican Party, because all those people flew out. And, you know, he ran an unconventional campaign with unconventional people, but unfortunately, unconventional sometimes means criminal.
So what's the next play for the Republican Party? I mean, I guess you can handle this from the idealist standpoint or the realistic standpoint. What should the Republican Party be doing right now in Washington?
You know, I think there are probably a lot of people researching the words high crimes and misdemeanors today, mm-hmm. and what it actually means. And I'm not sure that it's totally decided what it means, but the Constitution provides for basically three categories of impeachment-level offenses: treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. So what's alleged in the Cohen deal is basically that there was bribery. Mm-hmm. Now, normally when you talk about bribery, you're talking about bribery to a public official, mm-hmm. rather than a public official bribing somebody for a private matter,
to stay quiet,
which is what's happening
instance.
Here.
Right, right.
However, bribery has been seen as a high crime or certainly a misdemeanor. And so it's possible that that could be an impeachment level offense. Now, the issue here is impeachment is an inherently political process,
yes.
not a criminal process.
Right.
And so really what happens on an impeachment is just based on political realities. And are there really the votes? Now, you can kind of forecast down the road, maybe it doesn't happen in this Congress, but maybe the Democrats take over. Maybe there is this blue wave that they're saying, and maybe the news yesterday helps that blue wave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Democrats very well may impeach. Now, Mitch McConnell, if anything, is a political operator. He may decide that it's time to stick the knife in Trump and save the party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people might say, well, then the Trump voters are going to totally abandon. Well, that might be true. And there may be a time coming where there's more than one conservative, quote unquote, party or a party on the right to a certain degree. And that would definitely hurt the Republican Party in the short term. However, in the long term, as the Democrats continue to go to the left, continue to embrace socialism, continue to embrace the democratic socialists of America, and abandon some of the things that abandon Wall Street, abandon powerful influencers in our democracy, you wonder whether or not they don't have an equal and opposite reaction on the left that splits them as well. And you may end up with a multi-party system, at least for a function, for a matter of time. I mean, in our society, we've had times where there have been multiple parties. It doesn't last. We have a system that is set up to do two parties.
Right.
And people will eventually find their corners again. However, it seems like the two coalitions don't make a lot of sense right now. And if anything's going to break up the coalitions, it's something like the impeachment of a president that would.
Loaded, so many follow-ups. One basic one. Do you think that there are enough financial streams to support three parties?
That's a good question. I mean, you've got enough financial streams right now that they support both parties. I mean, and if they can...
You're talking about the Republicans and the Democrats. But
right.
what I'm saying is, are there enough financial streams, enough bigwigs, so to speak, to support two parties on the right or two parties on the left and the other third major party? I mean, you're saying there are going to be three or four potentially major parties.
Right. And I think donors would split just like everybody else. But there are some donors who give to everybody.
Right.
I mean,
right,
and they'll continue
right.
to do that because right. what they're doing is getting influence through their donations.
Right.
And so they don't really care who wins or loses. They just want to make sure they're there to congratulate the winner.
And then have influence on the back end. At this point, do you consider the president a criminal?
I don't know that I would necessarily go that far on the evidence that we have right now. But I think that there's definitely a possibility, given what Michael Cohen is pleading to and what he knows. If he turns state witness, we may find out just exactly what the president knew and when he knew it. And if that evidence comes to light, it's going to be very difficult for him to wiggle out. Now, Trump has survived things that no other president has or could. And so
yes.
maybe he wiggles out of this one somehow, too. And he's made a career out of surviving when people said his career was over.
And second chances, or third, or seventh,
right.
or ninth chances.
And he has a base that is very, very committed to him. And regardless of what is being said about him, either they don't believe it, or they say it doesn't matter. And so it becomes questionable whether or how those folks can be persuaded to leave him. I mean, he once said, I could stand out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they wouldn't leave. Well, he's just about done it. So how do we rectify that?
Teflon Trump, to some extent. You note he's unlike any other preceding U.S. president. Does this kind of Teflon nature, the ability to bounce back, the ability to just maintain this core support, no matter what, no matter criminal indictments, no matter exposures of extramarital affairs with porn stars, does it remind you of anyone else, either in the political sphere or, I don't know if an entertainer? Is this like anyone else in cultural nomenclature?
That's a good question. I mean, the closest thing that comes to mind is somebody like Mel Gibson, who like had a huge, serious scandal involving racism and some of the ugliest things that you're going to be able to catch on tape.
Right.
And yet he still has some amount of influence in Hollywood. He still makes movies and people still fund those. But you can't in 2018 come up with a scenario where Harvey Weinstein makes a comeback, you know, where a guy like Louis C.K., will he ever make a comeback? Is his career completely over? And yet Trump is accused and has done, I mean, it seems like from all evidence that is available, things that are even worse than some of those things that took down Hollywood stars and very powerful people. And so you just wonder, why isn't this being applied to the political realm in the same way that it is in the entertainment and other businesses?
You and I have talked about tribalism before. So much of everything that we talk about, politics, but also outside of that spectacle, seems binary. There's an A and a B. There's a black and a white. There's Team Trump or Team Cohen. Would you place yourself on either of those teams, or would you say, I'm not joining either one of these rosters, so to speak, right now? I mean, I know you're not on Team Trump, but like this twist by Cohen, do you side with him?
Neither of those people is on my team, so I'm not on their team.
Fair.
Okay. I would say that I think that there is this there's this troubling tendency I see on the left, but definitely among people who would call themselves never Trumpers, that they just kind of glom on to anyone who opposes the president for any reason, including Omarosa recently.
Right.
I mean, and just because the president is wrong doesn't mean who's fighting him is right. And so it's like, I don't want to attach my wagon to somebody just because they oppose the president or they're criticizing the president on something that I believe is a relevant and right criticism. And so I'm, you know, if Michael Cohen did what he did, he's just as much of a snake as Trump. So why am I going to trust him?
From your expectations, what do you think is the next development? What are you looking out for next in this particular saga?
Well, I mean, I think that the Mueller investigation has to continue. And if Cohen provides reliable testimony about what Trump knew and when he knew it and how it could be a crime, whether the president has, I mean, I guess he couldn't have really committed perjury. As far as we know, he hasn't talked to any of those lawyers. He hasn't, you know, been under investigation and had an FBI agent talking to him.
Best we know.
It's best we know. But I mean, I think that there is the potential that he has committed a crime. I mean, the other thing you have to remember about Cohen is it's not just like he knows what happened right before he was running for president. He's been the longtime lawyer of Donald Trump.
Right.
And the real estate business in New York is a place where crimes may sometimes be committed in order to put oneself at an advantage. So it wouldn't be all that surprising if he has evidence that's beyond just this bribe that may involve criminal behavior.
Brent Woodcox is your guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him at Brent Woodcox, C-O-X, on Twitter, where you're quite active. We'll get to Twitter here in a bit. But I do also want to chat briefly about constitutional amendments. The legislature proposed 6. 4 of them were challenged in court, 2 of which were challenged by the NAACP, and I believe it's Carolina Clean Air or Clean Air Carolina. I'm butchering the advocacy group's name, but those two were not held up, or those two were not struck down, rather, by the court. So we know definitively there are going to be 4 constitutional amendment questions before voters on the ballot in November. What remains unclear, as you and I chat here on a Wednesday afternoon, are 2 questions that pertain to executive power. Removing or shifting, or you can use a different word if you like, but adjusting some of the powers within state government. There was a 3-judge panel that heard arguments last week about whether or not to remove them, and they were removed yesterday by this 3-judge panel, a 2-to-1 vote. So where things stand now, and the reason I'm going to ramble on here for a second is I understand there's only so much you can say as it pertains to this. But the 3 judges have struck down those 2 ballot questions for the time being. The legislature, as I think I understand it, has 3 options. One is to kind of accept this and move on, and there will be 4 questions, and that's the end of that. 2 would be to appeal this up to the Supreme Court. Of course, we would note that the Supreme Court does have a split, 4 Democrats, 3 Republicans. That's not to say we know how the Supreme Court would rule, but that certainly is a consideration as you think about an appeal, and you are directly involved with a possible appeal. And then 3, there's also this option of legislators coming back, changing the language, because what was effectively blocked yesterday was misleading language. That's what the judges said. So the lawmakers could come back, could establish new ballot language for these 2 questions, or I suppose they could roll it into 1 question. They could come up with a new question or questions pertaining to executive powers. Quick fact check on me. Is there anything that you want to clarify or that I could better articulate or communicate?
The only thing that I would say is I think that the NAACP and Clean Air Carolina probably have an appeal.
That's right. Okay.
To the Supreme Court. And from what I understand, they are noticing that they are going to do that.
Okay. So. Yes. I knew that. Saw that on social media today. Fundamentally, what we're talking about is a balance or a separation of powers within state government. Why would it be important or necessary from your perspective to have lawmakers reconvene before September 1st to potentially reconsider this language?
Well, so one reason that you'd want to find that out is there actually is an ongoing controversy about who has power over legislatively created boards and commissions to make appointments. We've been having this fight since McCrory versus Berger, which is a case that originated because the legislature created a coal ash commission. They were going to appoint a majority of its members. The governor didn't like that. He wanted to have more say-so on how coal ash was going to be cleaned up. And he sued the legislature over it.
And won.
Basically, they said that if the board is performing an executive function, then the executive needs to be able to have sufficient amount of control and appointment authority over that board to make sure that he can execute the laws as is his duty under the Constitution. So then we can continue to argue about what exactly that means. What is sufficient control? What does it mean to execute the laws? How do we make sure that he has the appointment authority that is appropriate? So now we've had several cases, actually, between Governor Cooper and the legislature. And so in the most prominent case that made all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court, that was about the bipartisan State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement, the question was, can you have an evenly divided bipartisan State Board of Elections? And what the judges basically said is, this involves executing the law, and so as an executive board, the governor has to have sufficient authority and control over these people, including the ability to remove them, that he can execute his policy preferences. What was interesting is they did not go so far as to say he must have a majority of his own partisans to be able to be appointed to the board. But the dissent came in and said, well, obviously today's decision stands for the proposition that the governor gets to have a majority of his own partisans on the board. So even the majority and the dissent in the case could not agree on what the case stands for. So it's not exactly at all clear right now, and there are several cases that are going on between the governor and the legislature trying to figure out exactly what this does and how to implement it. So to the ability that the legislature has to present ballot questions to the people and make sure that the people can make their own decision, that they aren't denied the right to vote on their own constitution, the legislature is incentivized to try to come back and adhere to the court's decision.
A little bit of legal speak in there. Our governor is one of the least powerful in the United States. You know that, obviously. I think most of our listeners have probably gotten sick of hearing me say that. I mean, that was true under McCrory, that was true under Hunt, that was true under Republican or Democrat. Are these changes, the ones that were proposed, struck down, are these kinds of changes, shifting appointment powers to boards and commissions from the executive mansion to the legislative body, are they necessary?
I think that if you have a legislature that's creating a board or commission, it makes sense to have the legislature have a lot of say in how it's formed. I mean, they're going to fund it. They're going to make sure that it carries out the duties that it's supposed to. And
they the legislative or they the executive? Because currently that's more a function of the executive branch, is it not?
Well, the legislature has a duty to oversee the executive branch. I mean, that is how separation of powers works. One of the checks on executive power is legislative oversight. And we don't talk a lot about that and what that means. But it is something that they need to be able to do. Now, if the board is performing executive function, obviously the executive needs to be involved in that. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. It's just that for decades and decades and decades, it was considered law in North Carolina and conventional wisdom that when the legislature creates a board or commission, that they get to decide how it's made up and they get to decide who points who to what. That changed with McCrory versus Berger. You can argue that's a good change or it's a bad change. It definitely was a change in the separation of powers. You know, another thing that about the separation of powers is, yes, the governor is, from a constitutional standpoint, I would agree, has less power in North Carolina than the governor does in other states. Doesn't have a line item veto, doesn't have a lot of authority that other governors have.
Right.
However, I think that might be news to the governor. If you go into the court and you listen to what his attorney argues about what his authority is, he'll argue that he has executive authority wherever there is any board that does anything executively, and he has the authority not just to execute the laws. Of course, the executive has the authority and the duty and responsibility to execute the laws, but to impose his policy preferences, regardless of what the policy preferences of the legislature are and what laws they've enacted. So at some point, it feels like when the legislature makes laws, the executive executes the laws, that's proper separation of powers. The executive getting to decide what the laws are and how to institute his policy preferences, that's not proper separation of powers.
We're going to transition from President Trump to the three-judge ruling this week. We're going to – all right, one more question on this three-judge stuff. If I just, you know, conversation sake, said I was going to buy you a beer downtown Raleigh on Friday at 3:30 or 4, is that something you'd probably be available for, or you think you might be tied up this Friday at 3:30 or 4?
I think it's yet to be seen. I mean, honestly, I'm always one that I don't want to try to look into the crystal ball, because whenever I do, something will happen, like what happened yesterday afternoon where 10 stories broke at once, right, and I had no idea that they were coming.
Good luck with that.
And that changed everything. So the landscape can shift very quickly, especially as we come up on when we're going to need to print ballots soon.
Right.
We're going to see a lot more movement here in the next couple of weeks, I would think.
Or a couple days. All right. Let's move to Confederate monuments. Silent Sam was toppled on Monday night by students, largely students, from best we can discern, at North Carolina, who are back for classes. This is obviously a symbol that a lot of people are familiar with. This is a particular monument that has received much debate in recent years, if not decades. Let's start with the big question. Should Silent Sam have come down? Not in the manner in which it did, but should Silent Sam have been moved?
I personally am not a fan of Silent Sam. I mean, I think if you read the Julian Carr speech, he's bragging about beating an African-American woman simply because she was African-American, and that this was a display of his white supremacy. It's disgusting. I mean, it's exactly the type of thing that contextualizes a monument to show you what it was really about. That it wasn't about honoring anybody or remembering anyone. It was about trying to subjugate one race and put one race above another. And so to the degree that it commemorates and honors that, Silent Sam is not an appropriate monument to hold a place of honor, in my opinion.
Silent Sam is, we're gonna jump around a little bit here, but Silent Sam is down for the time being. Well, let's stick with Silent Sam before we move to downtown Raleigh. What should happen with this statue that was ripped down the other night? Should it be restored and put back up? Should it be put out in Johnston County at this Bentonville Historical Site? Should it be burned in effigy? Tongue-in-cheek there, but what should happen to this symbol?
I haven't thought about it a lot, other than to think, you know, how can it be placed in one of the most honored places, probably in North Carolina? I mean, that main quad there, mm-hmm, at UNC, and place I spent a lot of time when I was there, and it seems like for our state's oldest public university to honor it in that way,
our country's oldest public university.
Yep. That's just not the appropriate place. But I hope that a nuanced conversation can go on, not just about Silent Sam, but about just Confederate history at large. I mean,
but that's not happening.
It's not happening.
And both sides are at fault for that.
I agree.
I mean, I'm not trying to say this side is one third to blame and that side's two thirds. And we're not having a particularly rich or nuanced discussion about this for the most part. I think some people are. I hear from some people. I think, well, that's really interesting. In this moment of tribalism, in this moment of let's run to our corners and beat our chests and I'm right and you're wrong, or you're wrong and I'm right, whatever. Can you offer us any glimpse of a middle ground on this?
I mean, I hope that people will recognize that the South has a troubled history, you know, and it doesn't make the South worse because it has a troubled history. Our country has a troubled history, particularly on the issue of race. And the reverberations that take place from enslaving a whole group of people based on their race is something that you don't get past quickly. It's not a generational thing that you're going to get by. We forget a history of North Carolina that includes that the Civil War ended, Reconstruction began, and we started to send African Americans to Congress. We started electing in the state legislature. Then the government was basically violently overthrown around the turn of the century.
20th century, yeah.
And after that, lynchings took place, terrorism, intimidation, voter suppression. Every imaginable offense was portrayed to enlarge the political power of one race over another in this state. And it worked for 65 years or so. And some would argue it worked even longer than that.
Sure.
Based on the fact that North Carolina didn't even elect another African-American to Congress until 1992, and only after the federal government stepped in and required the state to draw majority-minority districts for the first time. So there's a troubled history to our state. And there's blood in the soil. You can't get out of it. You can't get rid of it. We can't erase our history. We have to face it head on. And we have to, if we're ever going to make progress, then we're going to have to acknowledge it happened, what its effects have been, and how we can get past them. If we really care about racial equality, if we really care about people having social mobility, the ability to get ahead, the ability to do better, to pass on to their children better than what they had. And I hope that we care about that for all people. And I think good people of goodwill on both sides do care about that. They may disagree about how we get there, but hopefully we can at least have that conversation.
So during that period you just talked about, the first half of the 20th century, we'll say, there were several Confederate monuments that went up here in downtown Raleigh. They are still standing. These were, and if they were in celebration of the Civil War or daughters of the Confederacy, that's good and well. But they did go up 50, 60, 70 years after the conclusion of the war. The three that are here in downtown Raleigh, what should happen with those?
You know, I think that there's probably a little more nuanced conversation surrounding those than Silent Sam, just because of their overall context. And you know, I don't think that it's necessarily inappropriate for people in the South to erect a monument to remember the Confederate dead. And I don't think that it's fair to impute our values onto all the people that lived at that time, or to assume that the only reason they fought in the war was slavery or because they believed in white supremacy. You know, some people were conscripted into that army. Some people probably felt like they didn't have any other choice. There were a lot of poor folks that were, that was their only way.
I believe, and you're more of a historian than I am, the majority of people who did fight for the Confederacy in North Carolina were not slaveholders. That doesn't mean that they were not supporters of slavery. But again, to your point, I mean, that's a fork in the road. That is some level of nuance.
Right. I mean, just like every war in the world, the rich people kind of direct the war, the poor people fight it. And that's the same thing that happened with the Confederacy. I think that, you know, for them, for those people to come forward after the war, and clearly during Reconstruction, that probably wasn't a possibility for them to be erecting any monuments, nor was it really appropriate at that time. But for them to say, we lost a generation of people, even though the cause was not right, even though the cause was defeated, and even though I think that our country is now stronger because we didn't put that behind us, but we moved on to a new era of what America is, and we more fully realized what the Declaration of Independence promised, what our Constitution promised. But I don't think it's wrong for them to say some of the smartest people of our generation, some of the best people that could have been something in the South, that could have been political leaders, that could have been business leaders, they died in this war. And we lost this whole generation of people, and we made many widows, and we made many orphans. And to honor widows and orphans, I don't think necessarily is out of bounds. But to honor the cause of slavery, or to honor white supremacy, or honor that, I think that is out of bounds. And you got to look at each monument and try to figure out why it was put up and what it actually honors.
A good answer, but you still ducked the question a little bit. What should happen with these three monuments? And is it, and let me just draw a little circle here on the floor, and I'll step into the idealist circle. The governor, Senator Berger, and Speaker Moore could get together and find some middle ground on this. They're not, let me step out of the circle of idealism and say they're not going to do that. And I think this is going to continue to be a political issue with eyes on November. Acknowledging that, what is the most realistic solution to this in the short term?
Well, I mean, the commission made a recommendation today, which was to contextualize these monuments more, to make sure that they're properly labeled, that people know what their history stands for, and to probably erect another statue that will honor African Americans. There's no doubt that we need to have a more diverse memory about who's really contributed to this state, and to understand and honor the accomplishments of people who were not in the favored annals of history at that time. And so I definitely think that that's appropriate. I think that moving statues is appropriate in some cases, whether to Confederate battlefields or museums, or some of them probably just need to be taken down and melted down because they're not really very quality art, and they honor something that's wrong, and they were put up for the wrong reasons. But you start to get pretty far down the road. I mean, why should Aycock be up there? I mean, he was absolutely a racist who used intimidation and terroristic tactics to try to control North Carolina and was very successful at it.
He was also the former governor.
Yeah.
The former governor, former leader of KKK or whatever.
Right.
I mean, he was a white supremacist and he had slaves.
And yeah. So you start to question how much of our history needs to come down, or at least be recontextualized. And we need to broaden the conversation beyond just Confederacy. And there's more to be said about that.
I want to that point, and we'll move on after this, but I wanted to ask you this. I had never thought about this until I had a conversation with somebody this week, and I'll leave his name out of it because it was a private conversation, but he said, we were talking about the lines and, you know, what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable, what needs to be changed, what needs to, you know, be considered to come down, so on and so forth. And he said to me, what about Tar Heel? And I was incorrectly, I was thinking, yeah, Tar Heel, that's a reference to the Revolutionary War. And he said, no, Tar Heel is a reference to Confederate soldiers. And full disclosure, this was a Republican person I was talking to. And he wasn't being snarky anyway. He was just raising the question. He said, if the monument should come down, should the nickname be changed? And I had never thought about that before. I thought it was a provocative question, if nothing else. You're a Tar Heel times two, right? Undergrad and...
No, just one.
Just one. Yeah. A Tar Heel times one. Do you have any issue with that nickname, Tar Heels?
I like you thought it also had a Revolutionary War context,
and that it also,
had some just beyond that, just kind of an attitude about we're not going to back down from anyone. Now, obviously, that could be a rallying cry for the Confederacy, and maybe was,
right.
And so maybe that's problematic. But maybe the term is a little more nuanced than just simply about the Confederacy. Might be the reason that you don't see quite as much. Pressure on the university to make that change, even though you do see it at other universities, Ole Miss Rebels. I mean,
you've seen
other, particularly with Native American mascots, where people have said, look, this just isn't appropriate at this time.
And there was a time North Carolina was a major exporter, creator of tar and turpentine. And, I mean, that was an actual substance that was produced here in the state.
Right.
I mean, I think it has roots there to some extent as well. All right. Some more quick moving ones, perhaps, to get you out of here on. There were two primaries yesterday, in addition to everything else that was going on. You're looking at me funny, which leads me to know what I think the answer might be. But Alaska and Wyoming, were you paying any attention, and what did you glean from those primaries?
I was not paying any attention. There was a little bit too much news going on.
Which political forecasts, projections do you pay the most attention to right now?
The one that just came out, because the reality is that...
What source?
I'm just saying
okay.
whatever is of
whatever
the moment,
okay.
because things are shifting so quickly. You have things like, you know, Donald Trump tweets something. Well, what does that mean for his approval rating? What does that mean for the generic ballot? Well, how will that predict how the races come out this fall? You know, what indictment could come down from the Mueller investigation? It's just... Unlike in many other times where 60 days out, you know, from an election, something like that, you could probably figure out, okay, this is probably the way the wind's blowing. I think the wind could change many times between now and then, and that many of these races are going to be decided on issues that aren't national in scope, because folks that with money are going to run as far away from the national political scene as they possibly can.
Right. Depending on the district.
Yeah, depending on the district.
Yes.
But in competitive races, I think people are going to try to distinguish themselves from not just only Trump, but all the entire Republican Party. And there may be Democrats who are looking to do the same thing. I mean, there are many Democrats who are running in competitive districts that may not necessarily always be competitive, but they want to distinguish themselves. I mean, you see that in NC9 with Dan McCready, that he's not running as a traditional Democrat. I mean, certainly he's a Democrat, but he's not necessarily taking up the traditional issues that a Democratic campaign would.
A personal question, pass on it if you want. Your birthday is September 11th. Does that suck?
You know, it was one of those things where I actually, in 2001, turned 19 on September 11th, mm-hmm. and 19 seems like an age that shouldn't matter. You know, you're not 18, you're not getting the right to vote or smoke, you're not old enough to drive, you're not old enough to rent a car or anything like that. It's just 19. Well, it's not a birthday I'm ever going to forget. And whenever anybody sees my license, they have to check my ID for some reason. They're like, ooh, that's a tough one. Now, I mean, I will say that in a strange way, because September 11th also commemorates a great opportunity that America had to come together. And unfortunately, that tragedy is what led to it. But I mean, this was a time when Democrats and Republicans saw eye to eye and all rallied around the same cause. And people went and gave blood, and obviously first responders went and gave their lives for people, and there weren't as many victims because people came together and they didn't ask whether we were Democrats or Republicans or black or white or Hispanic or Jew or Muslim or Christian, and everybody came together to try to do something. And so it's nice to be reminded of the good things that happened on September 11th every year when it's my birthday.
One of the most popular hashtags both you and I use is hashtag NCPOL, North Carolina Politics. who's the biggest troll in North Carolina political tweeting?
I probably don't know because I've either blocked them or muted them at this point. I think about probably a year or 6 months ago, I just decided it's just not worth it. I'm using this medium to try to communicate, and I enjoy it. And if I'm getting no enjoyment out of your presence, then I don't really need to see it anymore. And it gives me no greater joy than to know that a troll has come into my mentions and to mute them and know that for all intents and purposes, that person has disappeared from the earth for me.
Are you at times ever a hashtag NCPOL political troll, or are you policing the trolls? Or what is your relationship to those folks who are poking the bear a little bit?
I think that it probably depends on who you ask. There's definitely some people who say that I'm a troll. And look, you know, I can be snarky. I'm not going to sit there and say I can't. It's a God-given gift. I'm obligated to use it.
Is it from your mom, dad, grandma, grandpa? Where does it come from?
It's probably from my mom's side, okay. That's for sure. But I do try to add to the conversation. I mean, I have a knowledge about what's going on in this place. I have a knowledge about what politics is like and hopefully what the law is like, how it's changed. I've been following NC politics for a decade at least mm-hmm. now, so I have a little bit of history, although not as much as many folks that have come on your program and talked. So I try to add to the conversation. I try to be a nuanced conversation, to fact check where I think it's appropriate, to maybe interject something that's not being considered, and hopefully I can have productive conversations. I think I do. I mean, I have good relationships with the people on the left that we disagree with I disagree with often, and they disagree with me, but we can still go out and get lunch together or something like that.
He is at Brent Woodcox, COX on the end. I'm at J_TIBS, J Tibbs. We actually had a disagreement recently, or not a disagreement. We were having a back and forth about the purple nature, the purple hue, or the red hue of this state. We're going to leave that for another time because we're already, I don't know, 35 minutes in here. Brent Woodcox, general counsel, outside counsel. Did I call you general counsel before?
You're special counsel.
Special counsel. All right. Brent Woodcox, special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. Thanks for coming back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Stay up to date with all of the many happenings in your political world, the Trump-Manafort-Cohen developments, the three-judge panel here at the state level, also Confederate monuments. There'll be a story out later this evening, Wednesday, by our own Jason DeBruin. All that at WUNC.org. Thanks for listening to the podcast. You can subscribe if you don't already. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher. Recommend it to a friend or colleague as well. Thanks for tuning in. For Brent, I'm Jeff. We'll talk to you next week.
Walking due south out of Roanoke, I caught a trucker out of Philly, had a nice long toke. But he's headed west from the Cumberland Gap to Johnson City, Tennessee. And I gotta get a move on before the sun. I hear my baby calling my name, and I know that she's the only one. And if I die in Raleigh, at least I will die free.